system number 21558 real full.
Alan Miller, real full.
Okay. Well, we were eventually towed out of the anchorage by a vessel that was deemed not likely to have set off an acoustic mine. When we got clear of the danger area, we were able to go under our own steam and back to Pompey. In the dockyard, they haven't the facilities to move the barrel straight away. It was decided to cut it into two pieces, and that took 36 hours of continuous oxyacetylene cutting to get through the various layers that made up the gun barrel at the breech end. And then it was lifted, the pieces were lifted out. Eventually we got a new gun fitted, and we were able to go back on duty. And then we were sent to moor in the just inshore of the Goodwin Sands, and went out from time to time to bombard different targets. One time we went to, we had to go and do a bombardment on Le Havre, and that was the first time we got hit. One of the 55mm shells pierced one of the blisters, and it flooded the flour storage. So it upset the bakers, but nobody else. It didn't make us in any way unseaworthy or incommodious. And another occasion I remember quite vividly was being sent out to bombard Walcheren Island on the Dutch coast, and I think we're in company with the Warspite there, or one of the battle wagons anyway. I think we fired about 20 rounds into there, and then we were returning to base at night, and about 5 miles away between us and the shore, there was suddenly a huge eruption in the sea, and it seemed to be shot with little inside lights. It was quite a spectacle. And then there was a terrific sort of sledgehammer blow against the ship's side. It sounded as though somebody had hit us with a huge hammer. But it was one of our returning bombers that hadn't used its load, and it had jettisoned its bomb into the sea. it really was a spectacle, and it gave us a pretty good idea of what it must feel like to be in a submarine when you're being depth charged.
How far away did the bomb explode?
About 5 miles away, I should have to guess. Mm. Yeah. Of course, the concussion travels much further through water, or more forcibly through water, than it does over land. I think that was one of our last duties, really. And and eventually, VE Day came, and.
But before you go on further, did you get any feedback about the degree of success which your bombardments were having?
Yes. We got some quite good feedback from the bombardments of Catania Aerodrome in Sicily. Very little, really, from D-Day, because our initial input there was so short because of the gun bursting. But I did get the opportunity to go ashore in Normandy and see some of the damage that had been done by 15-inch guns. And there were two of the German heavy gun emplacements that had had direct hits, and they were, well, I've got photographs of them actually, they were really wrecked in spite of being heavy concrete bunkers. It had made them completely useless.
How happy were you in the Erebus as compared with the Carlisle?
Well, it's not fair to compare them, really, because in the Carlisle I was an able seaman and in the Erebus I was a lieutenant. And it makes a lot of difference.
From the point of view of comfort, you mean?
Yes. Well, I mean, I had my own cabin and I had a seaman to down my socks and iron my shirts and things like that.
What else did he do?
Made my bed and kept the cabin tidy. A lad called Lucas. We got on very well together. I mean, I think that was the... That was an impact of people like me in the Navy. I'm sure we made the relationship between the wardroom and the forecastle much different.
How do you mean?
Well, able seaman Lucas, for example. I could talk to him like I would talk to you. We talked as we would have done in civil life. And you could. He would go on. He would when he was doing his job. He would call me sir, but that was just occasionally. But if I was inquiring how his family were and that sort of thing, we just carried on an ordinary conversation. And there were quite a lot of. Quite a lot of both RNVR and RNR officers in the Navy with similar backgrounds. And I think it had an influence on the overall relationships. Whether since the war, when the Navy had gone back to peacetime routine, whether the things have changed, as it were, back again, I don't know. I have no experience. But I did feel that the invasion of civilians into into the Navy was a sort of leavening effect.
Was he called a Batman, or is a different term used in the Navy? Was he called a Batman?
Servant, I think. No, he wasn't called a Batman. No, at least I don't think so. But yeah.
So what happened to you at VE Day?
Well, Erebus was gradually decommissioned, and it was decided to send it into Chatham to become a depot ship. And the first lieutenant stayed on board, in charge of the ship, and I stayed on board as first lieutenant, and we had to supervise the transfer of equipment and removal of equipment and so on over to the dockyard. I got into serious trouble over that one time, because we still had some skeleton crew on board, of course. And one of the things we had to do was to move some of the machinery from the bakery, so that it could be taken over into Chatham Dockyard. Well, I mean, we had a shipwright or two and a torpedo men on board. So I got them to do what was necessary to disconnect the electrics and unship the mountings, so that they were ready for dockyard mates to take ashore. So I got into serious trouble for that, because there ought to have been an electrician, qualified electrician, to undo them, and a shipwright to loosen them, and a rigger to take. I'd transgressed the union rules, you see. All I did was get the job done. That's why you used to, when you were in dock, you used to see dockyard mates playing cards in one alleyway, because the riggers were waiting for the electricians, or vice versa, or the shipwrights, or whoever, and so they had nothing else to do whilst the other bloke carried on his bit.
So who complained to you?
The captain of the dockyard. That was a civilian in me peeping out.
Did you get any official reprimand? Any official reprimand?
No. No, just a verbal one. Well, one thing I did get, which I was pleased about, not in any connection with this, but after we'd been to Sicily, the captain called me in one day, and he said he was going to grant me qualified officer status, which meant that my such seniority as I had ranked me equal with the regular Navy officer, not as instead of being inferior as I would have been as an RNVR officer, which I was proud of.
Oh. How were RNVR officers treated in the war by the Navy, regular Navy officers?
Well, for my own part, I can only say very well. And I didn't come across any case of anyone being treated other than, shall we say, professionally.
So you're in Chatham Dockyard doing this job.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, it came to my turn to be demobbed. So I went home.
What was the demob procedure?
I had to go to Chatham, and they kitted out with a civilian suit and a trilby hat, and documentation and so on. Really, I can't remember very much about detail. It was the main concern was to use my travel warrant and get home.
How do you feel now about having served in the RNVR in the Second World War?
Oh, I feel it did me a tremendous amount of good.
In what way?
From a personality point of view.
Can you explain?
Well, I think it gave me, to some extent, a better sense of my own worth. Because I found myself amongst people whom, perhaps earlier in my life, I would have regarded as being more able or more sophisticated or whatever you like than myself. But I found that when it came to doing a real job, I could do just as well as they did.
Can I go back to Hull before the war?
Yeah.
What was life like in Hull as a city in the interwar period?
Well, it was a good city to live in, as far as I was concerned. And I lived in Worthing Street at Newland when as a youngster, and I had pals in the area. So some went to the same school, others went to a different school. But during holidays, we used to get together and do something constructive to amuse ourselves. I mean, if somebody would have a bat, and somebody would have some wickets, and somebody would have a ball, and we used to walk about, getting on for a mile, I should think, to a field on the River Hull bank, where we were allowed to go in. Nobody would interfere with us. So we'd have our games of football or cricket, whichever was in season, and opposite where I lived in the street, there was a square, open square, and then a terrace. We used to chalk wickets on the walls and play cricket in there, or chalk a goalpost, whichever. And we'd go for sometimes quite long walks along the fields on the River Hull, perhaps bird nesting and things like that, jumping the ditches and so on. Well, we always had activities, things that we were interested in.
How did life in the city compare then with what it's like today in 2001?
Well, it was much quieter, I would say, and much more orderly. Saturday night was the time when you had. I used to go out with my parents. We'd go into the town. You'd walk down White Frigate, which was as crowded as crowded as Hull Fair on a Saturday night. You go, there'd be the open market was on. Then there was the closed market, and there was what we used to call the shambles at the beginning of just past the King William statue on the left, and there was meat and poultry stalls in there, and quite a few live things as well. If you wanted to buy a rabbit, for example, a pet rabbit, that was a place to go, and things like that. You'd go down to the pier, and if you went to the pier in those days, you saw ships, lots of them. I was at the pier just a few weeks ago, and it was quite an occurrence. We actually saw two ships. But in those days, when the fishing fleet was in full spate, across tide time, it was quite exciting. You know, merchant ships going in and out of Albert Dock.
Do you remember anything about the general strike in Hull in 1996?
Oh yes. I was at school at the time, at the grammar school, and of course, in those, that was when we had the the electric trams going up and down all the main roads, and there were university students were driving the trams, and the windows, a lot of the windows were guarded with wire mesh, and there was quite a lot of unrest then, of course, and quite a lot of disruption.
Was there any violence?
Well, I suppose there was, but I never came in direct contact with any. But I know the students driving the trams were attacked.
Did you see that?
No. But I saw the trams being driven up and down Beverley Road.
When you were at Hull Grammar School, was there any connection with Holy Trinity Church?
not a strong one. Although I think there were quite a number of grammar school boys in the choir, the Holy Trinity Church choir, I mean, but I don't think there was the connection that there had been in the mid 19th century when the school was in the marketplace. Well, when I'd been in the Navy for about 2 years, I decided that I would sever my connection with the Guildhall, so as to make sure that when the war was over, if I did survive, I wouldn't go back. And then, in the later stages of the war, the The emergency teachers training scheme was announced, and I applied for that immediately. And about 4 months after I'd been released, I went to an emergency training college, and that was the beginning of my career as a teacher. And it's a change that I've never regretted. I enjoyed my life as a teacher from 1947 until 1977.
You were telling me earlier off the record about the decline in patriotism and its connection with standing up for the national anthem in theatres. Can you put it on the tape?
Yes. It was in the 1930s. We used to go regularly to the New Theatre in Hull and fairly frequently to cinemas. And there was an increasing tendency when the national anthem was played of various people to remain seated instead of standing up. And I've often looked back on that as a sort of beginning of the general laxity of behaviour that we're experiencing nowadays.
You mean it started in the 30s?
Yeah.
Why do you think that people started it?
Well, I think communism had quite a bit to do with it.
Were there communists that you knew in Hull?
Oh yes, there was quite an active communist party. And at one time I had a teacher friend who was quite closely connected with communism. I was never attracted to it, but I was sufficiently curious about it to go with him at one time to a meeting in the City Hall, which was addressed by one who was then a well-known communist called Pyratin. But I was not impressed by what he said or by the conduct of the meeting. The main object of the meeting seemed to extort as much money out of those attending as they possibly could. That was the only communist gathering I ever went to.
Why weren't you impressed by what Pyratin said?
Well, it was to me, it didn't seem to portray a way of life that was good for the nation or good for society.
Who was your friend who took you?
I can't remember his name now. I believe it was a chap called Webster, but I'm not sure. And he was at that time a teacher at another East Riding school.
About when would the meeting have occurred with Pyratin?
Well, I was at Anlaby. So it must have been somewhere between 1947 and 1952.
When Pyratin was an MP?
Well, I don't know whether he was an MP or... Was he?